a book club and podcast for anyone who wants to explore the best mysteries and thrillers ever written. I'm your host, Sarah Harrison.
And I'm your host, Carolyn Daughters. Pour yourself a tea or a gin and tonic.
But not a toxin.
No, and join us on a journey through 19th and 20th century mysteries and thrillers, every one of them a game changer.
Carolyn, what have we been reading?
Well, Sarah, we've been reading A Study in Scarlet by Arthur Conan Doyle.
That's right. This is part two, is it not?
It is part two. We also have a podcast episode on part one, which is amazing.
It's the best thing you've ever heard.
Until part two. until part two.
Listen to it first. It's nice that Conan Doyle actually split the book up into two parts. It's very, very convenient for us.
I felt it was very helpful and very convenient. This is the first Sherlock Holmes story, and which is why we're incorporating it into the books that we're talking about as part of our book club and podcast. We get the consulting detective for the very first time. We meet Holmes, we meet Watson. They're arguably two of the most famous characters in all of English literature, and they've transformed the way mysteries are written even today.
Yeah, I mean, this isn't one where I have to ask, like, why is this important? They're still making Holmes movies and TV shows. Yes. And like these characters just have real staying power.
Yes. Yeah, they do. And so in A Study in Scarlet, it's a story essentially of how this guy, Sherlock Holmes, solves the murders of Enoch Drubber and Joseph Stangerson.
Yes.
Yes. Before we get into our summary of part two, which we like to do, and all the questions that are just like captivating the two of us and we think would, you know, will be interesting to you as well, we have a sponsor.
We do. Today's sponsor is Carolyn Daughters.
What?
Woo! Who runs a brand building and communications consultancy. She leads brand therapy sessions, teaches marketing courses for startups and small businesses, and leads day-long persuasive writing workshops. Carolyn and her small team empower startups, small businesses, enterprises, and government agencies to win hearts, minds, deals, and dollars. You can learn more at carolyndaughters.com.
That sounds like a good idea to just check that out.
Go there as soon as this is over.
I mean...
Or pause it. You know, it's a podcast.
There's actually a couple things. I mean, they should go to teatonicandtoxin.com and then go to Carolyn Daughters. Have two windows open on your computer.
Go to the website.
Or your phone.
Leave us some comments and you might be listener of the month.
Listener of the month. We actually have one for this episode. And that listener is Angeline Donahue from Gaithersburg, Maryland. And we want to thank Angeline for being a member of the Teatonic and Toxin Book Club. And we really appreciate Angeline. We appreciate all of you who are reading these great books and listening to our podcast. So, Sarah, if somebody wants to get a sticker, because they should, because they're pretty cool.
Yeah, you get Angeline's going to get a sticker.
Yeah.
They're sweet.
What do people have to do?
Just about anything to let us know.
Except wave your hand in the air because we might not see it.
I mean, if you're in front of us, wave your hand in the air.
Yes, if you are in front of us, all you have to do is just say, what do I have to do to get that sticker?
Yeah, give me a sticker. You might be listener of the month. Mm-hmm. Yeah, leave a comment, ask a question, answer a question, mm-hmm. send an email, like 50 things, whatever.
Yeah, I mean 40, 50 things, or one, like one thing. Our website's teatonicandtoxin.com, and you can find us on Facebook and Instagram at teatonicandtoxin.
Which you should, because you'll want to get the next book for next month so you can read ahead of time, and this won't just be a spoiler podcast.
Which, you know, it's still fine as a spoiler podcast, because I think, you know, you get to hear us talk about a range of things. So
many things we think about.
You get to really just be in the brains of Sarah and Carolyn, and what more could anybody possibly want?
No, I want nothing more.
Yeah, no, that's really all I'm going for, too. All right. So part two. So we do have a part one. Please do check out that podcast episode. And this is part two. And we're going to start as we do with a summary of what's going on in this in case you haven't read and you want to know.
Yeah. Part two is really different.
Mm-hmm. It's mostly told by an unnamed third-person narrator. The story flashes back 34 years to 1847. A man named John Ferrier and a girl named Lucy are on the brink of death in a desert in the western U.S. A group of Mormons finds them on their way to a new promised land. The leader, Brigham Young, offers to help them if they convert to Mormonism. They agree and they become part of a new community in Salt Lake City. Ferrier adopts Lucy, who grows up to be a beautiful young woman and falls in love with a non-Mormon named Jefferson Hope. That name should be familiar to you.
Yeah, always together. Jefferson Hope.
Jefferson Hope.
Never Jefferson or merely Hope.
Lucy and Jefferson Hope plan to marry after Jefferson Hope returns from a job in Nevada. While he's gone, Brigham Young tells Ferrier that Lucy has 30 days to marry either Enoch Drebber or Joseph Stangerson, sons of the Mormon elders. Drebber and Stangerson visit and debate who has a better claim to Lucy. Ferrier, I'm having a lot of trouble with that name, throws them out, and the men threaten revenge. The next day, Ferrier finds a note pinned to his coverlid or his blanket, warning that he has 29 days left. Every day, a new number shows up around the house to count down the 30 days. With only 2 days left, Jefferson Hope arrives and helps them escape. He goes off to hunt for food one day, and when he returns, he finds an empty camp and a newly dug grave. Turns out Stangerson has murdered Ferrier, and Lucy was forced to marry Drebber. Jefferson Hope, devotes his life to revenge. One day he learns the men have broken from the church and moved away. Jefferson Hope travels throughout the United States and Europe and finally finds the two men in London. At this point, we return to Watson's narrative, which carried part one of the book. Jefferson Hope admits that he became a hansom cab driver in London, where he caught Drebber alone one day and forced him to take one of two pills, one harmless, one poisonous. Jefferson Hope took the other pill himself.
You can say Hope.
I can't, leaving it to God to decide who would die. Okay, after Drebber dies, Jefferson Hope writes R-A-C-H-E, Raha, on the wall to mislead the police. When he realized Lucy's ring was missing, he returned to the scene, pretending to be drunk to avoid suspicion. He sees Sherlock Holmes' ad in the newspaper, and he has a friend disguise himself to get the ring back. He then enters Stangerson's hotel room and tells him to choose a pill. Stangerson attacked him rather than choosing a pill, and Jefferson Hope stabbed him in self-defense. Days later, Jefferson Hope dies of an aneurysm. Sherlock Holmes tells Watson how he solved the case. He tells him all the details of it, and he also points to an article that credits Detectives Lestrade and Gregson of Scotland Yard for solving the crime. Watson decides to publish his account of the case to set the record straight.
Okay, we talked a little bit about Jefferson Hope's name in the last episode, but I can see, like, I'm reading a lot of the stuff that you wrote here, where it just does say Hope, and it makes the sentences so interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Hope stabbed him in self-defense.
Hope dies of an aneurysm. Scene.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hope travels throughout the U.S. and Europe. Hope goes off to hunt for food.
Yeah.
So, what is the deal with, I mean, we're kind of, when we were talking about Bleak House and Dickens and the names were so meaningful.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like we've almost evolved out of that with most of these books. But Jefferson, it's hard to have the name Hope and not feel like that's not on purpose.
Yeah, no, I would think it's on purpose. Yeah.
So do you feel like Conan Doyle's really sympathizing with the character of Jefferson Hope here, even though he's the murderer?
I feel like we are meant to, whether Conan Doyle does or not. I feel like I did sympathize with him.
I definitely did. I mean, I thought he was a great character.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that his name is Hope, but it's like Hope is Revenge, which is a totally different name. But his Hope is Revenge for like 20, 30 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's hanging on.
Yeah.
Hoping to kill these guys.
Yeah. He is the only hope of Ferrier and Lucy as the 30 days are counting down. Yeah. Ferrier sends this letter out with these guys are heading to Nevada. And with just two days left, Jefferson Hope arrives on the scene. He's like, okay, we got to get out of here in the thick of night. And there's sentinels around the house. So we're going to have to, really like do this cautiously and get, out of the way here.
And I guess I was actually a little surprised by that part since Ferrier was so tough.
Yeah.
He like was the only person in their whole wagon train to survive. And he carried Lucy in a sack on his back and just got to the point where they like were ready to die and kneeled down to pray. And, but then when it came and he was kind of like in this rich Mormon settlement, he was really depending on Hope. Like, I just thought he would bust his way out of there and shoot everybody. But I guess he became old.
I felt that was really odd, too. And the days are passing away, and he's not coming up with a plan. Yeah,
he's not coming up with any plan other than wait for Hope.
Yeah, his Hope springs eternal. We could do this all day, folks.
I know. Every sentence is
I thought it was weird. I thought that was weird.
Like when you're getting down to the last day, I wouldn't let it get that far. I'd be like, okay, we're going to dig a tunnel out of here, something.
But also, I don't know that I would have come up with that tunnel idea on the last day. I think I would have come up with it and then really like mapped it out and figured it out. And also Lucy doesn't seem to have a whole lot of agency because she's just sort of sitting around saying, well, God, I hope one of these two guys figures it out. Like,
yeah, it was really interesting too because they went to a lot of lengths to kind of describe how like independent she was and a great writer and did stuff on her own. But then it's like, maybe it was hopeless, but the minute like this threat kind of came down upon them, they're like, well, Jefferson's got to figure this out for us. Like, you live there. He doesn't live there. Yeah. Why don't you know how to escape from your own property?
I almost think, Ferrier just felt like he needed help.
Yeah.
And after all those years in this Mormon settlement, there seemed to be not even one friend he had or anything, which shows the disconnect between himself and the community.
Well, yeah, the way they paint the community in the book too, it's you might say the same about almost any person in the community might have felt that way.
Okay.
It was very much it reminded me of like Russia of the 80s or whatnot.
Yeah.
I was in Russia in the early 90s and still to this day, everybody has double steel doors on all their apartments, and like they whisper Putin's name.
Right.
And yeah, it was an area characterized by not knowing who your friends were.
Yeah, you get that sense.
Not knowing if you're going to get ratted out. Yeah, that's how they...
The Mormon community as described in this book is in Salt Lake City is like that.
Yes. Yeah, that's how they structured it here.
Yeah, where it's even a small indiscretion or whatever the church might consider an indiscretion can be punished violently. Or, you can be disappeared or however it would be described, where kind of like, in Russia of past.
It was a super surprising departure. Like, here I am reading about Sherlock Holmes in London, and then it starts describing this area in America, and I'm reading, it's like naming the rivers and the mountain ranges, and I'm like, wait a minute, that's where I live.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, because, we're in Denver.
Yeah.
And so the second part starts straight in with this story and this description of the sort of this hellscape, which just so happens to be, where we live.
Yeah, it's a Colorado, it says Sierra Nevada to Nebraska.
Yeah.
from Yellowstone River in the north to the Colorado in the south. Well, that includes Colorado.
I know that place.
I know, yeah. It's some of what's usually considered the most beautiful parts of the country.
Yeah.
So it really also surprised me, not only like, wait a minute, how is this about where I live? Mm-hmm. But the way it described it was arid and repulsive, a land of despair.
Yeah.
Like nobody goes to this place.
Yeah.
I just thought, well, that's interesting.
It's all about perspective, right? So if, I don't know, I mean, I guess it's one thing if you're Lewis and Clark, but if you're just a regular person and you're out in the middle of nowhere and you're wondering where your water and your food is going to come from, and you look at this landscape, you might think that this is, you know, this is terrible. Like, this is the worst place I've ever seen.
Well, it just made me think, you know, like how much of our aesthetic depends on kind of the usability, for lack of a better word, or survivability, or kind of like, you know, I think you might compare it to a person. Someone might seem really super attractive to you until they kind of show themselves to be of a violent or dangerous nature, and then maybe they aren't so much.
Yeah. Or just your exposure to something. So if you've never seen anything like this endless expanse.
Yeah.
Where you're, you know, you could just, I mean, you could potentially walk for weeks and not come across a river. I mean, that's this, right. So Farrier and Lucy are walking and when they're found by Brigham Young and the 10,000 Mormons. And, you know, they're the last of this entire pioneer group who've all starved to death and, you know, were too dehydrated and died.
Yeah, it describes the snow-capped and lofty mountains and dark and gloomy valleys, which I think the valleys are just, like, really beautiful.
Sure.
Like, when you get out to, like, the South Park area, it's like, oh, wow, it's glorious. But it reminded me, too, of actually the Moonstone, where they're always describing, like, the beach near the house is this horrible landscape of just like, it's disgusting. It's the ugliest beach you've ever seen. Who would go there? And I just, even in reading the Moonstone, I was like, beaches are pretty.
I want to go to that beach.
It always makes me think, like, am I just less discerning in my taste that I think maybe 100% of beaches are pretty? And so are all mountains. Like, the category of mountains is beautiful. But maybe it's not.
Yeah.
Like, maybe there's other things about mountains that make them beautiful.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting, too, because when they form this new community in Salt Lake City, the descriptions change. Like, of course, there's mountains around Salt Lake City.
Yeah.
It's I don't know, it's more livable, it's more friendly, there's some beauty to it. So I think a lot of it has to do with just, you know, this sense that they're just dumped in the middle of nowhere with nowhere to go, no one to save them.
Yeah, it's a very uninviting wilderness, that's for sure. When you can't survive it, it becomes like grotesque.
Yeah. And then it's such an interesting way to start this part two of the book. The part two is called The Country of the Saints. And we leave England. We're now shifted 34 years into the past. We have these new characters we don't know anything about. And there's a bunch of ways Conan Doyle could have told this story. The one way, of course, the way he did, where we get a new narrator and the story just abruptly shifts and the reader is wondering, did they publish the wrong pages here? Like, what's going on? Another way would be to work in chronological order, where the entire book would have started in 1847, worked its way forward. We get to the place where these two guys are in London and this guy, Jefferson Hope, tracks them down. And there's this detective named Sherlock Holmes who solves the crime, the murders. Or we could have had Jefferson Hope telling his story after Holmes captures him at the end of part one. Part two could open with Jefferson Hope saying, "Let me tell my story." "Sure, we would love to hear your story, Jefferson Hope." Instead, Arthur Conan Doyle makes this choice to shift narrators, shift 34 years, and really throw the reader for a loop. And so, Sarah, how did you feel about the decisions made here structurally with the story?
I mean, I felt like it worked for mm-hmm. sure. Mm-hmm. I just became very immersed in a totally different story. I was now reading a Western.
Right.
Which are also enjoyable.
Right.
And so I'm reading this Western and I just got very invested in the character of, you know, Farrier and Lucy. And I don't think, you know, had it been done another way, if this was all just Hope telling his story, like, he couldn't have gotten that.
Right.
He wasn't there right. when Sean Farrier carried Lucy in a sack and she found out her mother was dead.
Right.
You know, so it's telling it this way. It got you invested in actually the two original murders mm-hmm. of mm-hmm. Lucy and Farrier, which was horrible. Farrier,
and then Lucy dies of a broken heart or grief. Or yeah,
it was just awful.
Yes.
Like, you just were so happy they lived, first of all. Mm-hmm. They were immediately likable.
Mm-hmm.
And then happy they lived and, like, grew rich. And then, man, if they didn't get killed again. And then you're rooting for Jefferson Hope to travel around the world and kill these guys.
Yeah, which is, you know, super interesting because almost every point in time I was on Jefferson Hope's side.
Oh, yeah.
Like I was on Farrier's side when he adopts Lucy, who's not his biological child. Yeah. She's just the last living pioneer, along with himself, of this group that has all died off. And he says, "I will adopt her, and she will be my daughter, Lucy Farrier, Farrier, however we say his last name." And she grows up into this beautiful young woman, and she's, approaching marriage age, and everything just goes to hell in a handbasket.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was terrible. I mean, I feel like the structure really worked to get us invested. I don't know another way that would have been better at getting me invested loved in
it.
Jefferson.
I really loved it. I thought, okay, this book is a fast read, and, you know, in case you're looking for a fast, rewarding, page-turning read, I think this fits the bill, and it is so cool, and it's done really well. I think for a brief moment with the part two thought, I'm not going to be as invested in part two as I was in part one, because part one was all about Sherlock Holmes figuring out this and figuring out that. We lose sight of Sherlock Holmes and Watson for a good chunk of mm-hmm. part two, more than half of it. And it still works.
Yeah, it was really good.
Yeah.
I liked it.
Yeah.
It was a really interesting twist.
Mm-hmm. So let's, you know, talk briefly maybe about the elephant in the room. The Mormon faith is a star player in this book.
Yeah, totally surprising. Mm-hmm. I tried to Google of course, Brigham Young is a historical character, but I tried to Google Stangerson and Drebber and, like, were those actual elders? Is any of this, like...
Yeah.
I didn't get very far in my Googling, but most of the internet is just kind of, like, grumpy about Arthur Conan Doyle's portrayal of Mormonism.
Yes. So, you know, it's quite possible, probable even, that this is not a fact-based telling of what the Mormon faith was in the 19th century. Are there glimmers of truth? Possibly, but it's not for Sarah and me to say.
No, but you did pull out a really interesting quote when they're brought in front of Brigham Young. Mm-hmm. So they don't even decide they're going to save Lucy and mm-hmm. Farrier. They're mm-hmm. like, "We'll bring you to Brigham Young to decide."
Right.
And then he talks about, he pulled this quote here, "If we take you with us, it can only be as believers in our own creed. We shall have no wolves in our fold. Mm-hmm. Better far that your bones should bleach in this wilderness than that you should prove to be that little speck of decay, which in time corrupts the whole fruit." Mm. So what made you highlight that quote?
It's so interesting because you can, if you just want to, you know, decry a religion in black and white terms, you would just say, you can become Mormon and join us, or you can stay here and die. But he doesn't say that. He actually has a rationale for why he's not going to bring them unless they commit to being members, or unless Farrier, the adult, commits to being a member of the Mormon faith. And it's this idea that, you know, one spoiled fruit will spoil the entire community, essentially. And I don't know, like, I hadn't really thought of it that way, just that, you know, if you have a voice of dissent, so, I mean, you know, now we get into authoritarian governments and all the different things. Like, the voice of dissent is the most dangerous thing in the world, because one voice of dissent is heard by two people, and those people, you know, spread the voice of dissent, and suddenly the dissent grows. So there is danger in having a non-believer as part of the community, for sure. And yet, it just doesn't seem like a very Christian thing to do.
Right, right. Well, and there's this, there's often in kind of the scriptures these dichotomies that pull against each other. And I think, you know, he correctly kind of interprets one. You know, there's the principle of a little leaven leavens the whole lump. You know, just a little thing, it spreads very far. But then there's also the Christian principle of you should be in the world and not of the world.
Right.
Which goes completely against, like, a separatist society. So you have these dichotomies that pull against each other, and both of them, it's like they're true in their way, but one alone is not true.
Yeah.
You almost need kind of the other side pulling against it to find the balance.
Right. Right.
I think that's the part that kind of, it feels off, even to just, you know, take religion out of it. It feels off to humanity to be like, hello, fellow humans, I will leave you to die unless you agree with me. I'm sure I'd be happy for you to do that if our roles were reversed. It strikes the wrong chord.
Yeah, it's it was interesting. And then, you know, when Lucy becomes of marriage age, whatever, you know, so she's five when the novel starts, roughly 13 years go by. So say she's 17, 18 years old. And she gets engaged to this guy, Jefferson Hope. He's called a Gentile, which in the book I think means non-Mormon. And he is a minor, and he heads down to Nevada for a couple months and says, well, we'll get married when I come back up in 2 months. And Brigham Young goes to visit Farrier, and he says, your daughter Lucy is basically a prime heifer. And
I heard she's getting married.
You know, he basically calls Farrier out, saying, you're not married, you should have multiple wives, you have no wives, your daughter is of marriage age, she's going to marry the son of one of the elders, and she has 30 days to pick between these two guys. Farrier basically freaks out a little bit, like, oh my gosh, what do I do now?
With good reason.
Yes.
Turns out he gets killed. But
That basically he has no choice. So he's we hear from his perspective, from the third person narrator, I'm American. I don't have to give my daughter up to one of these two guys, right?
Yeah, and it kind of shows, you know, it's positioned as a choice, but they both sucked. You know, they kind of came in and had this terrible conversation about who should get her between themselves.
Yeah.
You know, it certainly wasn't like a wooing of her or anything.
Right. And Farrier's going to be sad to lose his daughter no matter what. But her choice is Jefferson Hope. And Farrier is not a fan of polygamy.
Mm-mm.
So there's a reason why, you know, maybe he's not married because he's mourning a wife that he had, or we don't really learn why, but he's not interested in getting married again. And he's certainly not interested in having multiple wives or having his daughter become part of a harem.
Yeah.
As he calls it.
Yes, they do in the book.
Yeah. But Brigham Young thinks he's being really fairly liberal. You know, he says, she's young. We would not have her wed gray hairs. Neither would we deprive her of choice. She can pick Drebber or Strangerson, or Stangerson, either one. Either one is great. And he says, we elders have many heifers, but our children must also be provided. So in his mind, he's like, here's his choice. And then these two guys show up at the house.
Yeah, he even used the word heifer. I forgot that.
Yeah. And they show up and they start debating which one of them has a greater right to marry, you know, to marry Lucy.
Yeah. Which is funny, is then later in the book, they both left the Mormon faith.
Yeah.
Both Drebber and Strangerson, like, went out and left the faith and traveled the world together. They're still getting murdered.
Yeah, so basically it's the way Mormonism is depicted in the book, which, you know, which we get is quite problematic in some ways. But it's like this Wild West out there, right? Mm-hmm. So we live in the land of freedom, if we want to say that that's what the United States is and was at the time. And yet there's this community where the rules or the laws of the land don't apply. Essentially.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, America has kind of that weird history that it's super interesting. Yeah. Even in the early colonies, you'd get these little colonies and they're like, well, this is where we're going to go because we don't get along with those groups. And then you get this group there and nobody just got all, they just wanted their freedom to be their own little groups to themselves.
Right.
And make their own rules.
Right.
And then as America expanded, you had to go farther and farther afield. But yeah.
And then finally the West was won. There was just nowhere else to go.
Yeah, I guess.
You know, I think so, right? It's like how, you know, the idea of going, you know, at one point in time, you could come to this strange continent, this strange place. You could head west and keep going west and keep going west. And there were lands to explore and, you know, lots of adventure. And now the West has been won. So, you know, where's our new frontier? Arguably outer space.
Space. Right? Although I think, and when I worked in Alaska, there's still quite a bit of that. There was, I'll always remember this guy came up to work in Alaska and he was from Montana. He was complaining that Montana was getting too crowded. Mm-hmm. And so he wanted to go where there was even less people.
So where was he going?
Alaska.
Alaska. Yeah. From Montana. Okay, so there would be fewer people. I mean, Alaska is
wild.
Yeah.
It is. So, folks, if you're looking to start an enclave with your own rules, you may find it in Alaska.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it was another really wild land. A lot of this reminded me of Alaska, actually, kind of the survivability of the land and this beautiful country that's completely deadly.
Yes.
If you can't survive. It's still so deadly.
Yeah.
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 Interesting. The countdown.
And yeah, so these two guys, Stangerson, which is very difficult to say. Say it a bunch of times and see how many you can get out. And Drebber show up at Ferrier's house. And, you know, like, one guy's got his feet kicked up on the table, and they're debating which one of us is the better husband for Lucy. And Ferrier won't have anything to do with it. He throws the two guys out of the house. Well, they decide that they're going to enact revenge. And so they do this countdown, which I think is pretty ominous.
It is. It is. And they were sneaking. So every day, and the very first day, there was a note pinned to his blanket. 29 days are given you for amendment and then.
Yes.
Dash. Yeah. And every single day there was a number somewhere counting it down and couldn't figure out how the numbers got in there. Like, it was almost a locked room mystery in itself.
Yes. I know. I was like, how are they?
They never revealed it, really.
Yeah, these guys are sneaky.
Servants slept in another place. Mm-hmm. Who's getting in there putting notes in a locked room? But
yeah, could you imagine, I mean, you know, waking up with this note pinned to your blanket? 29 days.
Yeah, so he gets his gun ready.
Yeah. And So the first, just to back up slightly, the first name that we get that we recognize as readers is Jefferson Hope. Because we know Jefferson Hope was captured by Sherlock Holmes at the end of part one.
You know, though, I didn't notice it.
I did, because it's such a distinctive name. It is. Jefferson Hope.
You're right. It's right there. So it said there, and then I guess I forgot about it. Once I started reading this Western, I was like, So I'm not a good reader, folks. I apologize. It was right there. And I was like, oh.
So the first clue that we're reading something tied to the first part of the book and that we weren't accidentally given some weird copy of the book that was put together wrong is, for me, was the reference to Jefferson Hope.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure that's how it was supposed to work, but I just got so immersed in the second part, I kind of forgot about the details.
Well, the other two names are Drebber and Stangerson, who we know are the two guys who were murdered.
I had to go back and look that up. I was like, really? So it was. That's how immersed I get.
Yes. Now, you know, when you're reading part one, I will say, like, I had no idea any of this story from part two took place. For me, there were no hints. So, but when I see those names, I'm thinking, okay, so there's intention here. Something's going on. What does this mean?
I was just rooting for Farrier and Lucy to live, but I guess I should have known better if I'd been paying attention to everyone's names.
We would have known better if we knew that Jefferson Hope is trying to hunt these two guys down in London, because we're like, this can't have gone well. And then there's this foreshadowing, right, where at some point, okay, they're escaping and they're several days out, and Jefferson Hope begins to think, okay, we're out of reach of this terrible organization. These guys can't catch us anymore. And then the narrator tells us he little knew how far that iron grasp could reach, or how soon it was to close upon them and crush them. And, you know, as a reader, knowing Jefferson Hope committed these murders, I already know that, but I'm like, oh no.
Yeah.
And then he leaves the campsite.
Yeah, I had to go hunting. They're out of food. I don't know. Again, I kind of expected a little more from Farrier. Or like a watch, or like why did they start a fire? I always get mad in movies, and I'm like, why are you starting a fire? You're just alerting everyone to your presence.
Yeah.
Be sneakier, please.
And it's always when they've been like lost for 6 hours and the temperature's nice and they're starting a fire to make some food. And I'm like, it's been 6 hours, just chill.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Come on. Be on your guard.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, that was really sad.
But he comes back. He sees a newly dug grave for Farrier. Lucy's gone. There's, you know, hoof prints. So
yeah, I also couldn't really figure out why he couldn't just sort of kill them. He had a month, or she didn't. I don't know. It's like, how did she get back and get married so fast? It just happened. He came right back. I thought one guy alone should be able to catch up with this group of people and like shoot some people.
Yeah. Well, he didn't have a horse.
Okay.
So he's on foot. These guys all had horses and took their horses, I think. So he's on foot, and I think he went back rapidly, but it took him several days. Mm. Maybe it took these guys, you know, a fraction of that time. And my picture is that they got to Salt Lake City and they were like, congratulations, it's your wedding day. Here you are. Get married.
Or like capture her out of there. She lived for a month.
Yeah.
Couldn't he like kidnap her out of there?
Yeah. But she was already married. I don't think he was going to kidnap a married woman.
That's crazy. Of course you should kid. It's not a legit marriage.
Yeah.
Even the America wouldn't have said it was a legit marriage.
Yeah.
She was like the seventh wife of Drebber or something.
Yeah, because one of them had, one had four wives, the other had seven wives or something like that. And yeah, right? So
like he busted in when she was dead and took her wedding ring. It was like, bust in when she's alive.
Yeah.
And grab her out of there.
Yeah. I felt that way too. And then he keeps trying to kill them and has all this difficulty, which made not a lot of sense. Like, why is it so hard to kill these two guys?
Yeah.
But he can't. And he's out in the hills and waits for them to, like, come out on the paths outside of the city. and he will try to drop a boulder on them or something, and he just can't do it.
Yeah, the boulder missed, and then they kind of were wise to him and were never anywhere alone together for the, like, the rest of their lives, for the next 30 years.
Right, and Jefferson Hope, his health turns poor, and so he goes back to Nevada to work to earn money and to improve his health. Then he comes back, and the, you know, Drebber and Stangerson are gone. They've left the faith, Mormon faith. They have left Salt Lake. So now he has to chase them all over the United States and the world.
Yeah, all over the world. Which he does.
Which is how we get back to Sherlock Holmes.
Well, and it was so interesting, too. Like, the way he killed him was, to me, bizarre. Mm-hmm. You know, with, like, the two pills. Mm-hmm. Like, one is a poison and one isn't. And they get to decide which pill they're going to take. It's very much like drawing straws or, like, leaving it to divine justice. After all that, chasing them around the world to let them potentially stay alive and kill yourself.
Yeah.
Like, that was very interesting to me.
I think that was part of Jefferson Hope's justice, is to not simply kill someone in cold blood, but it was instead to give them a fair fight, what he considered a fair fighting chance.
Yeah, and to me, yeah, it seems like he was saying, I'm not even killing you. I'm just executing divine justice on you by making you take a pill, and then, you know, God's going to decides
whether you
pill.
Live or die. What? Yes, which
or
one
whether
of us gets...
I live or die. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
yeah. And so there is that choice made by Drebber. Drebber takes a pill and he chooses poorly. And then with Stangerson, Stangerson says, "I'm not taking a pill," and he attacks Jefferson Hope. And so there's these two pills, right? In this pill box, and one is poison and one is not. And so Sherlock Holmes tests it on the poor infirm dog.
Right. Well, he didn't initially theorize that one pill wasn't poison. Mm-hmm. He was actually surprised for a minute before his genius realized, like, of course, one is poison and one isn't.
Mm-hmm.
I was glad to see him thrown for some kind of loop.
It is. It's rewarding. Because, you know, like, I don't know, when there's the superhero who has no Achilles heel or no flaw, weakness, to me that's really boring, you know? They're infallible. I like to see Sherlock Holmes thrown for a loop a little bit here and there.
I think that's why, you know, most people prefer Batman to Superman. Although I love Superman. He's great.
But... I actually don't prefer one to the other.
Really?
Not a huge fan.
But that's usually the reason cited. Superman is perfect and Batman is a mess.
Yeah. So. Well, Superman has kryptonite, right?
Yeah, he does have something.
But he's superhuman, unlike Batman, who is really quite human, right?
Batman needs to go to therapy.
Yeah. Yeah.
But...
for more reasons than that.
But yeah, that's... you know, and everything is just Sherlock saying, like, I knew it exactly how I thought it would be from the beginning.
Yes.
It's like, okay.
Yeah, so it's good to see Sherlock Holmes' intellect challenged every once in a while. You know, like, we don't want it to come so easily to him that he's bored. Boredom is the bane of Sherlock Holmes' existence.
Yeah.
It's very important to him that... you know, he says at one point early in the book that there's no crime or criminals worth studying, that even the detectives Lestrade and Gregson are commonplace and dull. And yes, they have a lot of energy, but that's really all they have going for them. And that sort of dull absence of challenge is terrible to him. And so you want to see the light in his eyes. You want to see him staring off into space trying to figure stuff out. I think that's good. I mean, it's good for Sherlock Holmes. It's good for the reader. Because we don't want this perfect guy who just marches in the room and he's like, done.
Yeah, well, there's a little bit like that. And you usually ask in the different books, like, is this a mystery? You could have figured it out.
And
in this case, it's like, absolutely not. You know,
although Sherlock Holmes talks about this as he calls it reasoning backward. And he says The grand thing is to be able to reason backward. If you describe a train of events, most people tell you what the result would be. They can put events together in their minds and argue from beginning to end that something will pass, will come to pass. But there are a few people, he says, who would be able to evolve their thinking backward so you know what happens and what are the steps that led to that thing happening. And that's the analytical ability that Sherlock Holmes possesses. And he says 1 in 50 people have this ability, essentially.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
do you agree with that?
I don't know. I mean, he is able to see this murder, and he sees the ring. He sees Raha written on the wall. He sees the footprints and the evidence that there was a hansom cab that drove up with three old shoes and one new shoe. And so he puts all these things together, and he's able to say, okay, from the stride, this guy must have been this tall. From the blood, he must have had a florid face.
It must have been from a bloody nose.
Right.
It's not like he got a wound or something, or
yeah, and you know, the width of the wheels of the hansom cab or of the vehicle suggest it was a cab and not a private vehicle. He's able to put together all of these different pieces in a way that most people at least at the time would not. This the skills that he displays have become way more common in mystery novels and maybe even in detection generally since this book was written. But at the time, this was really quite uncommon, I think, that somebody could do what he does.
Yeah. I wonder how realistic it is. Because mm-hmm. It's those things that sound great. Like, oh, he's running around measuring everything. Mm-hmm. So he's measuring this guy's stride around the room.
Yeah.
Man, what kind of room are you in where you can totally measure a stride? I've been in lots of rooms and I can't measure any because
But he's also measuring outside in the garden, so
he is.
He's taking all of this data that most people wouldn't take. I mean, the detectives, you know, one of them says, "Well, it must be Rachel that's being written on the mm-hmm. wall," because they can't think any further beyond that, and yet Holmes goes two steps further. One, he says this is a German word for revenge. And beyond that, it's just something to mislead the police.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that some guy was so bent on revenge that he took time to take his own blood and write this word. Like,
right. Well, he should have wrote Rachel, I guess, to mislead the police. Yes. They were misled in a totally different direction.
Yeah, they weren't even picking up on the secret society.
Yeah, he had to tell them the way they were going to be misled.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like he needed to leave some cliff notes, like, you know, a little sticky note or something like, "Hey, guys, this is a German word."
Like, yeah.
So he's several steps ahead of everybody. And I don't know. It just to me, it's interesting because I think the reader probably cannot figure out what Sherlock Holmes figures out. But I don't know that we're presented with all of the information. But we are just with Edgar Allan Poe and the Dupin stories, the murders in the Rue Morgue, for example. We're supposed to be impressed with what the detective accomplishes, and I was suitably impressed.
Yeah, it is some of this stuff sounds like you could do it, although I don't know if it's even true. Like, I'd like to see the data on stride and height correlations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is that really real? Has he analyzed that?
Yeah.
And just those types of things mm-hmm. to see, like, okay, that sounds really plausible. Is it actually plausible?
Right.
But that's just how my brain works.
Yeah.
It did make me want to try and play the game myself, mm-hmm. I would say. I definitely, like, observing a scenario or like seeing something happen and then taking my guess at what the situation is that brought that to pass.
Right.
But I don't know that I've thought about it in terms of reasoning forwards or backwards. So I kind of want to unravel that a little bit and see if that's something to try and do.
It does feel like the reasoning forward is far more common and far simpler. And the reasoning backward is quite challenging, and that's the art of detection. And I mean, as a population, we're fascinated by that. First of all, we're doing a podcast called Tetonic and Toxin, which focuses on this, but true crime podcasts, all the CSI shows, the Law and Orders, and every, all 500 British mystery series. And so we're fascinated by this reasoning backward.
Yeah. Figuring out crime.
You know, Holmes says this really interesting thing at one point, and he says, what you do in this world is a matter of no consequence. The question is, what can you make people believe you have done? Oh, that hit me. It really did, in particular because Sherlock Holmes, in this newspaper at the end of the story, the newspaper basically says, Lestrade and Gregson, we're amazing. What amazing Scotland Yard detectives.
Yeah, maybe Holmes can learn a thing or two from them.
Yeah, over time, maybe he can have a degree of their skill. Wow, right? Like, I mean, to me, I think that hit me because, and maybe you as well, but as humans, we have all experienced where someone else gets the credit for the good things that we've done. Like, we do something good, and then someone else is like, oh, yay, you know, applause and all this stuff. Like, oh, that person's amazing. You're like, I did that.
I mean, the other side, too, I think we're always having to come up with ways to show that we're good at something. You know, like, what is a resume? What is a credential? All of these things that we're trying to give people to help them evaluate whether we're good or not good.
Yeah.
And how helpful those things are or not helpful. You know, do they really tell the truth? Are they an actual reflection of our skill?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. It struck me a little bit, but, you know, the idea that it's what you make people believe you've done. So this is the resume that shows this, you know, I years ago worked for a corporation and, was hiring people and hired this guy to head up my editorial team. And his resume was just golden. He was an amazing interviewer. And so he was the senior level guy on the team. And he didn't know, it turned out, half the things on his resume. Oh, and so it's really what I thought he knew versus what he knew. And I remember talking to the head of engineering at the time. So this was the sort of the editorial documentation department. There was an engineering department as well. And he said, oh, we get that half the engineers here don't know what they say they knew on their resume.
Wow.
What? Yeah. And so they, you know, I know Java, C++, all the stuff. And I'm going to get all the lingo wrong because I'm not cool like that. I don't know the tech. But all the stuff they know. And then they come in and they're like, I don't know what that is. And it seemed really commonplace, but it's like what you know versus what people think you know.
Well, the deal is, though, I don't think Holmes even believes that. Otherwise, why is he doing what he's doing?
For the challenge, I think.
Yeah, he's doing it for the
challenge. The love of it. Because he could probably become a police officer or police detective if he wanted, or a private detective. London's filled with police detectives. London is filled with private detectives. He is the one and only consulting detective.
Yeah, so he clearly can't believe that what you do is a matter of no consequence. He's making totally different choices, and I think, I mean, it's certainly true that what people believe you have done impacts you, but, excuse me,
yeah,
I don't think you can take that as your operating premise, and he doesn't himself.
And there's a sense of honor and justice with several of the characters where Jefferson Hope gives these two men, Drebber and Stangerson, a choice. Here, take one of these pills. One has poison, one does not. That's his sense of honor. And then also at one point, Sherlock Holmes says to Jefferson Hope, tell me about your accomplice, because I haven't figured that part out. And again, the reader's like, yes, finally, Sherlock Holmes hasn't figured it out. And Jefferson Hope says, I can tell my own secrets, but I don't get other people into trouble. That's his, again, his code of honor. Mm-hmm. And then Watson has a code of honor at the end of the book where he says, he's upset that the newspaper has published that Gregson and Lestrade have solved this crime. And he says, your merit should be publicly recognized. Mm. You should publish an account of the case. If you won't, I will.
Yeah.
I mean, what did you feel about Watson in that moment when, you know, the book basically concludes in this way?
Well, I guess I just kind of felt like, thus the launch of Sherlock Holmes.
yeah.
Like, that to me is, like, Jefferson Hope's sense of morality honestly does really resonate with me. Like,
yeah,
you know, wanting to see justice done, whether or not the law was going to do it. Mm-hmm. You know, wanting to sort of allow that divine intervention. Mm-hmm. Not that that is what I think is necessary, but that, you know, it resonates. I get where he's coming from. Not wanting to get his friends into trouble.
Yeah.
I get where he's coming from. Watson, I'm like, okay, I don't feel like that's a moral imperative that Sherlock Holmes gets the credit.
But I think that's who Watson is.
Mm-hmm.
You are my friend. I know things that other people don't know. I don't like when other people get credit for things that you have done. I am going to set the record straight. I felt it was an honorable thing for Watson.
Yes.
And to be fair, Watson has some time on his hands, so he could do this, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And so he does.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Well, we have wrapped up another podcast episode on this lovely Sherlock Holmes story that I recommend everyone read.
Yeah, really a quite short story with that. And next up is the book I started reading like 3 books ago. I got all mixed up because I did not look at tetonicandtoxin.com when I should have.
Which has a schedule on
it. It has the schedule, folks.
It tells you what to read. It tells you what order.
Don't be a Sarah. Look at tetonicandtoxin.com.
Yeah, tetonicandtoxin.com. Yeah. So, Sarah, what is our next book?
The Big Bow Mystery. Mm. And so far, so good. I've really enjoyed it when I started it a while back.
Tell me something about this book. I have not started this book.
Oh, well, that's cool. Carolyn kind of came up with our list here with all of the reasons why.
Apparently randomly, since I haven't read the book.
This is set in London's working class East End. The Big Bow Mystery is one of the earliest examples of a locked room mystery.
Mm.
And in fact, they do cite Poe in it.
Oh, well.
Yeah. Pretty early on.
Fun.
In this short 1892 novel, two detectives race to solve a murder. An innocent man is condemned, and only at the very end is the startling solution revealed. It says it's a fast read, 3 to 4 hours.
Oh, and page turner from what I've heard.
Yeah, so far I would agree with that assessment. So yeah. I'm looking forward to completing it. Kind of forgot what I was... I can't read more than one book at a time, honestly. Mm-hmm. It's terrible.
The Big Bow Mystery, Israel Zangwill, Locked Room Mystery. That's what we're going to read next. Everyone, please get reading because our list is pretty darn good, I have to say. And I have enjoyed reading everything that we've read thus far.
It is. And I have as well. And if you have things you want to add or think our list is incomplete, please, by all means, comment on tetonicandtoxin.com.
On Facebook
and Instagram.
Facebook and Instagram at Tetonic and Toxin. We will see you next month.
Yeah, and if you can think of like a cool closing sentence, post it on the Facebook.
We need. Yeah.
And maybe we'll use it and you'll win a sticker.
Yes. If you come up with our closing sentence, which apparently we're desperate for, you will definitely get a sticker.
Keep being mysterious.
No,
that one. No. Okay. Give us some ideas. Thank you, listeners.
Thank you.